what we lost when we lost Bobby Kennedy.
We got to see what 3 years of a JFK administration would look like, and it was hopeful, and he did some good things, but he never aroused the passion and the hope that Bobby did. And the idea that that was unfulfilled hope somehow makes the loss of Bobby even more tragic than the loss of Jack.
That's Larry Tye. We talk with him about his biography of Robert F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, the Making of a Liberal Icon. Then, the sometimes surprising lessons of history.
Historical fiction, I think for it to work, it has to echo the current moment. It has to reflect on the current moment in some way where the past can inform the present. So, in this book, I believe that the political reflection is that sometimes the most defiant thing that people can do is take care of one another.
That's Stephen Kiernan. We talk with him about his novel of life under the Nazi occupation of France, The Baker Secret. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Today we commemorate two momentous events, both of which took place on June 6th. Later, we honor D-Day, June 6, 1944, with a novel that comes to a head on that day. But first, we explore the life of Bobby Kennedy, a life cut short on June 6, 1968. Larry Tye has written a superb biography of Robert F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Tye's portrait of Kennedy doesn't shrink from his subject's failings, but it also reveals the depths of his capacity to evolve, the awakening of his moral sense, and his ability to empathize with the downtrodden. It's what made Bobby Kennedy, by the end of his life, so loved by so many, the repository of hope for a country looking to bind up the wounds of injustice and division. History remembers Robert F. Kennedy as he was in his crusade for president in 1968, a racial healer, a tribune for the poor, and an advocate for getting out of Vietnam. But Bobby had once argued equally passionately for intervening in Vietnam. He'd okayed the wiretapping of Martin Luther King Jr., and he launched his career as counsel to the left-baiting Senator Joseph McCarthy. So I started out by asking Larry Tye to explain these two disparate portraits and how they could be reconciled.
I can explain them, and I probably can't reconcile them because they're irreconcilable. I can explain them by saying that the Bobby Kennedy, at the start of his public career in the 1950s, was an extraordinarily different figure, and he was somebody whose first job was for Joe McCarthy. He went to work for him not just because his father told him to, although that was a good enough reason, but because he believed in what Joe McCarthy was doing. He thought that Joe McCarthy was the one guy in Washington who was speaking out about the Soviet threat, not just in the Soviet Union, but behind every pillar in the State Department. He was a chip off his father's very conservative, very Cold Warrior block. And that was absolutely the Bobby Kennedy who, in his trip to Vietnam, promised the Vietnamese we'd be there fighting at their side, you know, against the communists from the north. And this was the early Bobby Kennedy. And I guess the best that I can say is that he was, in the 1950s, a reflection of what at least half of America was in the 1950s. Joe McCarthy, it is easy to forget because we now understand who he was and we've seen him exposed. Joe McCarthy had popularity ratings that were at 50%. He was the second most popular person in America behind Dwight Eisenhower, and at times Eisenhower worried that McCarthy might be more popular. So Bobby Kennedy was a perfect reflection of what America was in the 1950s, and in the 1960s, he was a perfect reflection of how America was changing and had changed. Only instead of just echoing that change, Bobby Kennedy helped steer the change. He was out ahead of the curve. He was transforming as he learned and grew. And he, in a way, to me, redeems the notion of politicians being able to redeem themselves. And I think that's a pretty exciting notion. So his transformation is not reconcilable, but it's exciting, and it gives us today hope that maybe other political figures at a time of difficulty now will learn, will grow, and will become better in the way that Bobby did.
Mm. And what do you think it was about Bobby himself that gave him the capacity for such profound change?
So I think it was something partly innate in him, and partly that this was a guy who was looking to try to establish himself, to try to establish his self-worth when he had grown up in an extraordinary family of 9 kids where his father had dubbed him at a very young age the runt of the Kennedy litter, the one who was least likely to make anything of himself. And Bobby spent his life trying to prove his father wrong, and I think he did it in a very compelling way. But it made him insecure enough, unlike his brother Jack, who never doubted himself, and I think that was one of his weaknesses. Bobby had enough self-doubt that he understood that he had to grow and learn. And I like to say that Joe Kennedy's dream for his children, and especially for his sons, was that each of them would succeed one another as president, a not exactly modest notion of what his kids ought to do. Rose Kennedy, the matriarch of the family, had a much more modest dream for her children and especially for her sons, which is that one of them would find their way into the church as their calling. And had Jack Kennedy done that, I think he would have been the Pope, because that was who Jack Kennedy was. He was an elitist. He was intellectual. He liked to be above and be dictating to people. Had Bobby Kennedy ever gone into the church, he would have been a parish priest, because that was how he learned, at the grassroots, admitting flaws, and really growing along with the people that he was serving. And that's what Bobby did his entire life.
Wow, that's fascinating. Now, how did Bobby Kennedy go to work for Joe McCarthy? I mean, you mentioned his dad, and he was, of course, very close to his father. But why didn't he see that McCarthy was a ruthless demagogue?
Partly because he was a naive young guy, not the brightest guy in the world. He was he wanted to go to Harvard Law School. He couldn't get in. He ended up graduating in the middle of his class, smack in the middle, at the University of Virginia. Years later, very few law professors had any clue of recognition unless they happened to have known the Kennedy name at that early point. And so he didn't have a million options when he graduated from law school. And the fact that Joe Kennedy had given enough money to Joe McCarthy, that McCarthy was offering him a job, was reason enough to take it. He also, again, having grown up in that Kennedy household, the idea of being a cold warrior and a pretty conservative guy was not unusual. So not a whole lot of questioning of his father and the values that were instilled in him, not a whole lot of questioning of Joe McCarthy. And after 7.5 months, when he finally left McCarthy, it was never because he really questioned much about Joe McCarthy. He hated Joe McCarthy's young acolyte, Roy Cohn, who was Bobby's nominal boss. And he always blamed any excesses by McCarthy on Roy Cohn, which I think was letting McCarthy off the hook and was having a convenient enemy in terms of Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn, by the way, your listeners might remember, was not just Joe McCarthy's protege, but 35 years later, he was Donald Trump's tutor.
Exactly. I was, in fact, going to mention that next. So why did Bobby Kennedy hate Roy Cohn? And he eventually, he prosecuted him.
So two sets of reasons why I think he hated Roy Cohn. The obvious reasons are that Roy Cohn was an obnoxious character and very easy to hate. He was out there convinced that he was the smartest guy in any room he was in, and he often was. He was out there convinced that Joe McCarthy ought to listen to him and not the competitor across the office, Bobby Kennedy. But there were another set of less sort of sympathetic reasons why Bobby disliked Roy Cohn. They had grown up in entirely different universes. Bobby grew up with a whole lot of money, in a very Irish Catholic world, in a very white and non-diverse world of Hyannisport, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, and Palm Beach, Florida. Roy Cohn was brilliant. He was Jewish. He was very much of New York. He didn't have a whole lot of money, and he was everything that Bobby wasn't. And I think that those two worlds clashed in a way that nothing sort of on the surface could quite explain it, and you knew there had to be other things going on. Roy Cohn, because Bobby was Joe Kennedy's son, and Joe Kennedy was a notorious anti-Semite, blamed it on anti-Semitism. I think it was less that than just different cultures.
Now, after Joe McCarthy fell, Bobby himself, you know, remained in the investigative, I'm not sure what the name of the committee was anymore, but he turned his energy to ferreting out corruption. Talk a little bit about that and how that eventually may have led to him going after Jimmy Hoffa.
It was the most important and notorious committee or subcommittee in Congress at the time, called the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. And after Joe McCarthy was censured, that happened to be the very moment the Democrats were coming back into power. So McCarthy lost the chairmanship of the subcommittee, not because of his censure, but because the Republicans went into the minority. A guy named John McClellan, a crusty old senator from Arkansas, took over. Bobby became his chief counsel, the position that Roy Cohn had held with McCarthy. And Bobby and Senator McClellan went after, in a very strident way, what was supposed to be both unions and management, looking for corruption in both. It ended up focusing almost entirely on unions. It ended up focusing almost entirely on the biggest union in America, the million-member Teamsters Union. And Bobby went after corruption first under a president of the Teamsters that nobody's ever heard of named Dave Beck. And when Dave Beck was tossed out, Jimmy Hoffa, probably the most famous union leader in American history, took over. He was incredibly popular among the membership. He did amazing things to build up the power of the Teamsters, and he was corrupt. And Bobby saw that corruption, couldn't see why union members would support him, felt that he was selling them out, and went after with a vendetta against Jimmy Hoffa that surpassed even the vendetta he had against Roy Cohn.
And you say in the book, Larry Tye, you say in this book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, that actually Bobby Kennedy and Jimmy Hoffa had more in common than either could acknowledge. What do you mean by that?
So they both were single-minded in the pursuit of what they thought was right. Hoffa thought that whatever little side deals he had, that he was never really enriching himself, and he felt like he was out there looking out for the members of his union, and anybody who couldn't see that must be an idiot. Bobby Kennedy thought that Jimmy Hoffa was out enriching himself and was single-minded in his egotistical pursuits, and anybody who couldn't see that must be blind. And the two of them were passionate about what they did. Their supporters were passionate about them, and they could just never see the world from the other one's perspective. And 50 years later, when I interviewed the current president of the Teamsters Union, Jimmy Hoffa Jr., it was incredible, because the things that Jimmy Hoffa would come home and tell his kids at night about the evil Bobby Kennedy were exactly the things that Bobby Kennedy was coming home at night and telling his growing brood of children about the evil Jimmy Hoffa.
Now, when Bobby Kennedy did go after Hoffa, and actually we're going to skip ahead a little bit to Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General, he really pushed the limits of civil liberties and due process. Explain what he did, and do you think he abused his position?
So I think he definitely abused his position. I think that he really did have that Jimmy Hoffa was somebody worth going after, but Bobby wasn't intent on sort of going after him once. He was going after him repeatedly, and he finally got him on a charge of jury tampering. And I think that even people who loved Bobby in the Justice Department felt like this was a bit over the top and a bit Bobby settling old grudges. And on the one hand, Jimmy Hoffa wasn't a guy to arouse sympathy. On the other hand, civil liberties did matter. And I think that this was the Bobby Kennedy of the Joe McCarthy era, where civil liberties went out the window when you were chasing communists, and Bobby repeated that mistake in letting them go out the window when you were chasing, whether it was organized crime figures or union bosses that he thought were corrupt. And he thought that the ends really did justify the means in taking bad people off the street.
Reading your book, Larry Tye, it struck me that, you know, there was a certain politicization of the Justice Department that had some resonance with attempts by our current president to, you know, make the Justice Department his. You know, you could almost argue that John F. Kennedy might have thought about Bobby Kennedy being his attorney general. I wonder if you could talk about the parallels and whether you see some differences.
Sure. So I actually, when our current president was proposing appointing his daughter and son-in-law to very senior positions in the government, I wrote a story the next day for the Boston Globe saying that that really did draw up for me all these memories of what happened in the Kennedy administration. And in fact, the reason that Donald Trump couldn't name his daughter and son-in-law to senior positions was because of an anti-nepotism law passed after the Kennedy administration and known by everybody on Capitol Hill as the Bobby Kennedy Law. And there was a feeling that while Bobby Kennedy started out as a clueless attorney general, maybe the least qualified to be in that position of anybody in the modern era, and Jack Kennedy joked in those early days that he was naming Bobby to the Justice Department to give him some legal experience, his brother who had never tried a case in a court of law, Bobby ended up being a great attorney general, and I would argue one of the best ever. But that still didn't justify the president naming his brother. And when Joe Kennedy told Jack Kennedy, the president, to name Bobby as attorney general, I don't think he was doing it for the benefit of the country. I think he was doing it because he knew that Bobby would be there protecting Jack's back and that he would have a friend in the cabinet who would look out for the president's best interest. And while that's good for the president, I'm not sure it's good for the country.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess we should be glad that a JFK wasn't involved in the kinds of what it appears to be corrupt deals that President Trump is, because one could question whether he would have allowed any kind of investigation of him to go forward.
So those are really good questions to raise. There's a piece of me that wants to choke in comparing about anything Jack Kennedy and Donald Trump. On the other hand, we've got to hold the standards are there for every president and not just for bad ones like we have now. And I think that I'm glad that there's an anti-nepotism law. I'm glad that it's been put to good use with this administration. And I'm glad that while Bobby Kennedy was an incredible attorney general, I'm glad that presidents can't name their brothers to any cabinet position today.
Now, on the positive side, could one say that Attorney General Bobby Kennedy cleaned up organized crime in America?
So I think we can say he did three things that really stand out as his legacy as Attorney General. One is saying that he cleaned up organized crime. I wouldn't go that far, but I would say that he waged the most aggressive war against organized crime that any president before him or any president since has tried. And given all the rumors about Joe Kennedy's ties to organized crime, that was an especially brave thing to do. The second thing that he did was, while he started out not particularly understanding what was going on in the civil rights movement, he ended up being the best president, the best attorney general in civil rights that we had ever had. He's the one who pushed Jack Kennedy into proposing a good civil rights law. He's the one who protected the demonstrators at the civil rights demonstrators at Ole Miss when there was violence by angry whites trying to keep James Meredith from registering there. He's the one on a very different issue that intervened, and this wasn't his role as attorney general, but in his role as what I call co-president, helped intervene on the side of a blockade during the Cuban Missile Crisis that got missiles out of Cuba and that kept us out of war. He was there doing more things on more good issues for his brother than anybody in the cabinet did, and he was the closest thing that America has ever seen and will ever see to a co-president, because no president would ever cede the authority and the decision-making prowess that Jack did to Bobby. Nobody will ever do that again.
Yeah, and talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, now Bobby Kennedy wrote a book about it called 13 Days. But you say that that book was not exactly truthful in every way. So talk about that book. I mean, it became the definitive history of that time, and where it got it right and where it got it wrong.
That's a great question. 13 Days at the time was the only look we had inside the Kennedy administration in terms of what happened during those horrible 13 days in October. And I think that the truth was that Bobby Kennedy got it right on about six of those 13 days, that he made himself out to be the hero, to be the sort of moderate who was steering a course between doing nothing, which was unacceptable, and going to war against Cuba and Russia, which was unacceptable. And the course of the naval blockade, which turned out to be the successful course, was compellingly told by Bobby Kennedy as the way he was advising his brother Jack. And Bobby was the hero of the book 13 Days. In his view, he was the hero of the missile crisis. And that was a great story, except that what Bobby never anticipated happening was the tapes were made public of the actual live conversation in the cabinet room during those 13 days. And those tapes make clear that Bobby Kennedy, for the first 6 or 7 days, was in fact talking for an airstrike to take out the Cuban missiles, and an airstrike that could have put us at war, not just with Cuba, but with the Soviet Union. And he was as bad as the generals were at the beginning of the crisis. And by the end, he was in fact an advocate for the blockade and was an advocate for moderation and was his brother's best advocate in the cabinet. But that's not the way it was for the whole crisis. And Bobby spun the story when he told it, and we believed it because we didn't have proof to the contrary.
Yes, I mean, as I remember, it was the back channel between JFK and Khrushchev that kept us out of war.
So it was, and Bobby was actually the critical factor in that back channel. It was Bobby that Jack Kennedy sent off to meet the Soviet ambassador and pass word to Khrushchev, and that was another thing that never made it into the book, 13 Days, and into the Kennedy family telling of the story. That was the fact that we were actually, it wasn't just us putting pressure on Khrushchev and his backing down. We had agreed to a secret deal where if Khrushchev took the missiles out of Cuba, we would take our missiles pointing at the Soviet Union out of Turkey. But part of the explicit deal was that it could not be seen as a quid pro quo. The missiles would come out of Turkey looking like they were just a separate after-the-fact gesture once the missiles were removed out of Cuba. But in fact, it was a quid pro quo, and the Kennedys just realized that it would be bad for Jack's reelection if it were seen that day. There was one other critical piece of the story that Bobby never told, and that was why the heck Khrushchev put the missiles in Cuba and why Castro wanted them. And the answer was, one of the big reasons why Castro was so worried was that Bobby Kennedy had been waging a secret war with the CIA and the rest of the American military establishment to try to assassinate Castro and bring down the communist regime in Cuba. And that was a war that was waged from the end of the Bay of Pigs invasion, the unsuccessful invasion of Cuba, to the beginning of the missile crisis. And that's why the missiles ended up there, because there was really a threat of American invasion of Cuba, or at least American displacement of the regime there. And Castro felt he had no choice but to ask his Soviet pals to protect him with missiles. So Bobby didn't tell why the missile crisis happened. He didn't tell the first half of what really happened. But he was, by the end, the hero that he described himself as.
Yes, he was behind, is that right, behind Operation Mongoose, which used ex-Cuban mafia, Cuban-American immigrants here who were involved with the mob and others in attempted assassinations of Castro. You write that the Kennedys' Cuba obsession and the underhanded tactics it spawned, you know, all those assassination attempts, for example, became a legacy that long outlived both JFK and RFK. How do you make that conclusion?
So I make that conclusion partly the evidence in terms of Operation Mongoose and Bobby's role in it is now public in terms of released documents from the CIA, lots of documents from Soviet archives, and we know that whole backstory now in a way that Bobby never thought we would, and that doesn't make him look especially good. But in terms of understanding the legacy of that, so few people understood this quid pro quo deal that we had during the missile crisis with Khrushchev, and so few people understood what we were really doing that set up this crisis, that when it came to Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson wanted to stand tough like he thought Jack Kennedy had during the missile crisis, and that was one of his excuses for staying in there, for ratcheting up the bombing, for increasing the troop strength. He didn't understand that, in fact, behind the scenes, things weren't what they seemed. And had he understood that, and had he understood that it wasn't just the tough guy, it was the diplomacy that really got us out of the crisis, historians think, and I agree, that he might have been more flexible in looking to diplomacy rather than the military as a solution to Vietnam. And I think that any time things are presented as simply as they were in Bobby Kennedy's book, 13 Days, that leads people in the future to make mistakes thinking that the world is as straightforward as our staring down the Russians and having them blink first.
Now, Larry Tye, in this book, your wonderful biography of Bobby Kennedy, you talk about the JFK assassination, of course, and Bobby's attitude towards the Warren Commission. He did not cooperate with the Warren Commission that, you know, investigated the assassination. Why was that?
So he didn't cooperate. If you had asked LBJ why Bobby wasn't cooperating, why he was let off the hook, Lyndon Johnson would have said because he was so traumatized and he just didn't want to talk about it. It was too painful for him to deal with. I think that there's a different reason why he didn't cooperate. He felt that the only way we were going to come up with the real answers is if he was someday the president, he, Bobby, and could control the levers of the investigation, that he never trust the president that he didn't like, Lyndon Johnson, to get to the truth about Jack's assassination. He thought that Johnson just wanted to clear it up and move on with his own presidency, and that was probably at least partly right. I think that Bobby also, I believe, took to his grave a sense of guilt about whether he had somehow stirred up a hornet's nest that had come back to sting his brother. I think he worried that maybe it was his war on organized crime and that the mafia had something to do with his brother's death. He worried that maybe it was his war on Jimmy Hoffa and that the Teamsters had something to do with Jack's death. And most of all, he worried that maybe it was his secret war against Fidel Castro, and maybe Castro had somehow been involved with Lee Harvey Oswald and the killing of Jack Kennedy. He was never sure about that. He always felt guilty about that. And he felt that the only way he could get to the bottom of it was in 1968 to be president himself.
Larry Tye. Stay tuned after the break as we talk more with him about his biography of Robert F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon.
And a time of sorrow. It is not a day for politics. I have saved this one opportunity, my only event of today, to speak briefly to you about the mindless menace of violence in America, which again stains our land and every one of our lives. It is not the concern of any one race. The victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are most important of all, human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Larry Tye about his terrific biography of Robert F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Before the break, we talked about some of the less savory aspects of RFK's career, the quote, ruthless Bobby Kennedy. But there was another side, the side that led to Robert F. Kennedy becoming that beloved liberal icon. So let's talk a little bit more about his positive legacy. You tell us in this book that he had a profound transformative experience politically and personally when he visited a sharecropper's shack in the Mississippi Delta. Tell us about that and the impact on him.
So what happened was there had been testimony in Washington in front of a committee that Bobby was on that people were actually starving in America. A young civil rights lawyer, the first woman, African-American woman, to pass the bar in Mississippi, a woman named Marion Wright, who is today Marion Wright Edelman. She testified that people were starving, and they were starving in Mississippi. And Bobby and the other senators were so shocked that they agreed to go to Jackson, Mississippi, to hold a hearing. They held a hearing, very compelling evidence in Jackson, the same way there had been in Washington. Most of the senators piled back on the plane and headed back to a comfortable weekend in Washington. Bobby said, I want to see the poverty that you were talking about. I want to see whether there really are starving families out there. He ended up going with Marion Wright to the Mississippi Delta, to one of the breadbaskets of America, but also one of the poorest places in America. He went into sharecroppers' shacks. He actually, in one shack, got down on the floor with a child with a distended stomach to try to make some human contact with this little boy. And he saw poverty, he saw starvation, and this was on a weekend, he went back to his family estate in Hickory Hill. He delivered a speech to his children about the fact that their dining room that he was talking to them in was about the size of where three families would be living together in the Mississippi Delta. He told his kids that they had a responsibility to give back something in their lives. And his kids were so taken by his speech that 50 years later, they can recite it verbatim, and they have at book talks that I've done. And the next Monday morning, he went to see Orville Freeman, the Secretary of Agriculture, and he convinced him to change the rules for food stamps so that people no longer had to pay some nominal sum for food stamps because there were people who couldn't afford anything and who were starving. So as a result of Bobby's trip, it wasn't just that he learned and saw and changed himself. He changed the rules of the way food stamps are done so there were fewer starving people in America as a result of his trip to the Mississippi Delta.
Now, by this time, RFK was running for president himself. Lyndon Johnson declared that he was not going to accept the nomination of his party as president. 4 days after Johnson's announcement, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Tell us about the speech that Bobby delivered that night in Indianapolis.
So the speech in Indianapolis was extraordinary. What happened was Bobby Kennedy was flying in on the plane, the family plane called the Caroline. He was out campaigning in rural Indiana. He flew in that night to Indianapolis, greeted at the airport by the young mayor who became an old senator named Richard Lugar. Lugar told him that Martin Luther King had been shot and killed. He said, Bobby, you will not go in tonight to the ghetto in Indianapolis and give the speech that you were planning to give, because if you do, you might not come out alive, and there might be a riot there. Bobby listened, ignored the advice, went into the ghetto, jumped up on the back of a flatbed pickup truck, and for the next 5 minutes gave what may have been the most pitch-perfect speech, certainly on the issue of race, that has ever been delivered in American history. It was all ad-libbed. It was from the heart. It was the first time in 5 years that Bobby had talked about what it meant to lose his brother. He couldn't bring himself to say the words Jack or brother. He still referred to it as a member of my family. That was the closest he could get. But what happened that night was magical. He goes into the black community to embrace them for the loss of Martin Luther King Jr., and instead they embrace him for the loss of Jack Kennedy. That night, Indianapolis was one of the only cities in America with a sizable African-American community that didn't riot. It didn't riot because Bobby told people to go home and say a prayer for their country, and they did. That night, Bobby established himself as what I think was the most popular white man in black America. And in every speech he gave for the rest of his life, which was 2 months, everywhere in the black community that he would talk, there would be a little sign that would go up and say simply, "White, but all right." And that may not sound like much, but 50 years ago, given the racial tensions in America, for a black community to say that about any white leader was really something profound.
Then on June 6, 1968, Bobby Kennedy was murdered. Of course we can't know for sure, but what makes you think that Bobby would have won the Democratic nomination if he hadn't been killed, and that he could have beaten Dick Nixon?
So I think that he would have won because the next morning, the famous last words that Bobby delivered before he was gunned down in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel were, "And it's on to Chicago, and let's win there." And that actually had a double meaning. The "on to Chicago" was partly on to Chicago that summer for the Democratic National Convention, but what people didn't know is that he was on to Chicago the next day to meet with, in a private meeting with Mayor Richard Daley, the powerful mayor of Chicago and the most powerful big city Democratic power broker that there was. And Daley's son tells me 50 years later that there was an 80% chance that his dad was going to endorse Bobby that next day. And had Mayor Daley endorsed him, I think it would have set off a wave of endorsements by other powerful Democrats. If he had shown up in Chicago with all of these primary votes and with so many powerful backers like Daley, I'm convinced the delegates would have had no choice but to nominate Bobby. I'm convinced that it would have been a ticket of Kennedy-Humphrey, because that's what happened in those days. It was the two most powerful people in the party who would unite in the end the same way Jack Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson had. And I'm convinced that there was nobody in America who better understood the vulnerabilities of Richard Nixon than the guy who 8 years before had run his brother Jack's successful campaign against Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. But don't trust me. Richard Nixon was convinced, as he wrote in his memoir, that it was going to be Bobby Kennedy that he faced off against that November. And Richard Nixon was worried about that.
You know, you quote John Lewis in your book, Larry Tye, that something died within all of us who knew Bobby Kennedy when he was assassinated. Well, I didn't know Bobby Kennedy, but I remember feeling that something had died, and I know what it was. It was hope that died within me. So I wonder if you could talk about your own feelings, what you felt when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, and whether your thoughts about Bobby Kennedy changed during the course of writing this biography of him.
So I think that there's something. We got to see what 3 years of a JFK administration would look like, and it was hopeful, and he did some good things, but he never aroused the passion and the hope that Bobby did. And the idea that that was unfulfilled hope somehow makes the loss of Bobby even more tragic than the loss of Jack. And Bobby was also running at a more turbulent time. And I don't know about you, but I've spent the last 50 years waiting for another tough liberal, or depending on one's take on this, humanistic conservative, to come along and really offer that same kind of hope. And that hope is especially resonant today, not because it happens to be the 50th anniversary of Bobby's assassination, but because America is more divided than it's been in the last century. And I think that Bobby Kennedy, one of the hopes that he offered, was precisely the hope of uniting angry white voters, the kind who were with Bobby from his early Joe McCarthy days, with the kind of voters at the end that Bobby had with him, which were the Hillary Clinton coalition of liberals and minorities. And the idea of a candidate who could bring those two groups together is something that to me resonates incredibly in our divided era of Trump today.
Well, Larry Tye, this is just a gripping biography of Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy, the making of a liberal icon. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about it.
So it's great to be on with you.
Larry Tye is a New York Times best-selling author of several books, including a biography of public relations pioneer Edward Bernays, Rising from the Rails, a book about the black men who worked as Pullman porters on the railroad, and Superman, the nearly real-life story of that American hero. Go to writersvoice.net to watch Bobby Kennedy's speech announcing the death of Martin Luther King Jr. And next week, we continue exploring the legacy of Bobby Kennedy on civil rights when we talk with David Margalek about his book on the relationship between RFK and Martin Luther King Jr., The Promise and the Dream. Next, a novel about the German occupation of a small town in France that was liberated on D-Day, June 6, 1944. Don't go away. This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When tyranny takes over, maybe the best form of resistance is to take care of your neighbors. That's the premise of the novel The Baker's Secret by my next guest, Stephen Kiernan. Set in a small coastal village in Normandy on the eve of D-Day, The Baker's Secret is a tale of courage, determination, optimism, and the resilience of the human spirit. It tells the story of a brave young woman named Emma who creates a cunning circle of support for her community under the nose of the German army. She does this by using her simple talent as a village baker, ensuring that her neighbors can live until they're free again. In addition to The Baker's Secret, Stephen Kiernan is the author of the critically acclaimed novels The Hummingbird and The Curiosity. Well, Stephen Kiernan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Delighted to be with you.
So this novel, The Baker's Secret, it takes place during the German occupation of France in World War II. Give us the setting of the book.
Well, setting is a very important part of it because the landscape is a huge element in how the characters live. It is set along the coast of Normandy. There is a town that is the principal location called Verger, which is the French for orchard, and there are lots of apple trees in that region, and they're not used for eating, they're used for making the Calvados apple brandy. And I visited and researched a lot around that area and ended up inventing a town, but I have it sort of near Lons-sur-Mer, and this is a small town that is, maybe a mile away from the ocean, and it is a place that is key in the invasion on D-Day. So these are people that are living in an occupied situation. They have no rights. They have no weapons. They have no local governance. And their challenge is to take care of one another. And some of them believe they'll be rescued someday. And some very central characters believe that the Allies will never come and that this is how life is going to be forever. The Third Reich says they're going to be around for 1,000 years. And then, lo and behold, the Allies show up 300,000 strong.
Right, and in a very dramatic fashion, that's the culmination of the book. What drew you to write a historical novel about this period?
I was in the place where the muse abides, the men's locker room at the local YMCA, and I go there to swim because I have old back injuries from playing rugby. And there are some older men who come in to the gym there, and they don't exercise, but they do set up in the chairs around the TV and turn the TV up and take a little nap. They call it the executive workout. And so I was getting changed after a swim, and they had the TV turned up, and it was June 6th of 2009. And I know that because what was on the TV was a news report about the celebration of the 65th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. And the British Prime Minister spoke a little bit. Gordon Brown said a few words, and at that point, pretty new president, Barack Obama, said a few words, and then they introduced the French president, Sarkozy, who was going to get up and give a speech, and then the TV station cut away to a train derailment in Arkansas or someplace. So I never got to hear what the French president was going to say, and I thought, I wonder what the French view of D-Day is, and I don't really have any idea. And I started thinking about what it would be like to live under those circumstances and to perhaps be rescued. So with that in mind, I forgot all about it. And a couple of weeks later, I went online looking to find the speech and to see what he said. And whatever Google search I did, what came up first was the number of people from each nation that died on D-Day. And the numbers are staggering. You had 5,200 American boys died that day. You know, about 400 an hour over the course of the daylight part of the invasion. Just an incredible sacrifice. And 1,100 Brits and 600 or 700 or 800 Scots and about 1,000 Canadians and so on. And there at the bottom of the list is the number of French people who died that day, and it was 11,800, more than all the other nations combined. And I thought, not only is there a story here, but it's a huge story. And that just started me reading, and from there emerged my village and the people in it and the people who are heroic in the way that you would have to be heroic to survive in those circumstances.
Introduce us now to your protagonist. She's a remarkable young woman, Emma.
Emma. So her full name would be Emmanuelle, and she's from a line of stubborn women. Her grandmother, her mother who's no longer alive, but they're all sort of famously stubborn, grouchy women. And she is enormously talented at baking. And so the man who runs the bakery in town takes her on as an apprentice. And from that, she learns some skills that are about baking, but she also learns about what a bakery's role in a community is, particularly a French community in that time. So she is completely pragmatic. She can come up with ways to feed people when there is no food. And she can devise a very elaborate system of barter so that everyone gets what they need so they can survive. At the same time, she's very stubbornly non-romantic. She does not believe the Allies will come. She says, hope cannot be traded for butter. It can't be eaten. Therefore, I have no use for it. And yet she behaves as a person with very deep hope in that she constantly makes self-sacrifice to take care of her fellow villagers.
So talk a little bit more about this notion. You know, she doesn't have hope. And she's such a young person. Why do you think that she doesn't have hope, and why did you create her that way? What is the fulcrum of that in the story?
Well, I believe at some level that she has a very, very deep and profound hope, and that is why all she does all day is take care of other people. But her hope is a pragmatic one. That is, her hope is that she can help people survive one more day. And she'll do everything she can for that. And she's not going to take the dreamy hope that someone's going to come rescue her. If I could, I'd like to step out of the book for a minute and talk about a cultural moment that we are in, and that I believe actually started around 9/11. And if you look at film since 9/11, the most successful films, the most popular, most financially rewarded films, are all about dire, dire circumstances and a superhero, a super being with incredible powers and all kinds of special aspects is going to rescue us. And we can be the bystanders, and it will be taken care of for us. That's really what Hollywood believes. At the same time, in the exact same cultural moment, if you look, there's been a huge new literature of World War II. And in those stories, whether it's All the Light We Cannot See, or Light in the Ruins, or The Nightingale, or The Baker's Secret, I boast to put myself in the league of those other books. They're all way better. But the point is, there is a whole literature that says, no, it's not going to be a superhero that saves us. We are going to have to save ourselves. And I don't believe that anyone had that strategy. I certainly didn't when I started. But if you look across the panoply of films and the array of novels, you'd have to say these are two different ways of looking at our culture and time. So I certainly did not want Emma to be a superhero. She is as plain as can be. She's actually somewhat beautiful, and she makes herself uglier so that the German soldiers won't notice her. And she is just about bread. Can I get some bread to someone who is starving today? And I will, and I'm determined to. And that is a very muscular kind of hope. That is a hope in action that ends up sustaining not just her, but this whole village and countryside.
And I think that's beautifully put, and bread is really a metaphor in many ways. So plain, but the staff of life And also don't sell yourself short. I mean, this was a terrific read, The Baker's Secret.
Thank you. Thank you.
You know, but it did strike me, you have an interesting little kind of Q&A as an appendix to the book, a kind of interview. Emma and you are interviewed on their questions, and she says she's not, she says she's not a hero. People think she's a hero, but she's not. She says, I did, you know, what anybody would do. And what struck me about that is, as I know that, for a fact, I mean, it's the ordinary heroes. You know, before we began doing this interview, I told you that my father had been in the Dutch resistance. You know, he was not a special person other than the fact that he was young and extremely adventurous, which probably allowed him maybe to do more things than others might have done. But he just did what he felt he had to, you know, that he just couldn't stand by. And I've heard that from so many people. Ordinary people who did extraordinary things.
You know, I think about how I would behave, you know, in the circumstances that your father was in or that the characters in my novel are in. And I don't think I'd fare very well. I'm not very good with authority, for example, especially kind of random authority. I'm very respectful of earned authority, but if it's unearned, I'm kind of dismissive of it. And that will get you shot by a German soldier, by a Nazi soldier, in a minute. And there's a way that these people in this town were cunning, and they used subterfuge, and they suppressed their immediate emotion for long-term goals in ways that really worked. I think there's one other ingredient that's important to say. You know, the French lost so many young men in World War I. The equivalent loss in America today would be 16 million young men. That's how big a chunk of the population died in World War I. The male population had not fully recovered by the time World War II came around. And it's one of the reasons, I think, that there was an armistice with the Nazis. They simply didn't have the strong army. They didn't have the population for it. One result of that is that many of the heroes, not just of the resistance, but of all of the survival efforts, were women. It was actually a demographic thing that led me to say the hero of this book must be female, because if the hero was male, he would have been shot. He would have been conscripted to a German factory. He would have been put into forced labor building the Atlantic Wall. And it was the unique role of women and the ways that women are smarter than men that made her a much more interesting centerpiece.
So now describe for us, Stephen Kiernan, describe for us that cunning that she exercised to create a circle of support.
Well, I have to start by confessing that I'm not very cunning. And it was an enormous challenge in the writing of this book to have a cunning character. And it required me to do some things I'd never done before. I had, next to my computer, on one side I had a map of the town, because the geography, where everything is, really matters. And you need to have the German soldiers in one place so that Emma can be up to something in another place. And so I literally had a map. But the other was that I had a list of things that everyone wanted. And I spent, you know, there's a whole section of the book. The book's in five short acts, and one act is called Want. And it's about everyone, you know, Emma discovering what it is that everyone wants. And someone is a light bulb, and someone is some fuel, and someone is some tobacco, and all of them it's food, and some it's companionship, so many things. And I had to really kind of work that out, and it took a long time to sort that out. And then once I had everyone's wants, then the novel wrote itself pretty quickly, because everyone was walking around in a scene and they had their wants. You know, Kurt Vonnegut said to begin a scene, just make sure everybody wants something, even if it's only a glass of water. And I don't write at all like Vonnegut, but I remember that adage because each of these people wants something, in fact, many things. And the only person who doesn't seem to want anything is Emma, except that she wants everyone to survive. Mm. When the invasion is... I'm sorry?
She wants her soldier to come back, too, who we never know what happens to him.
Oh, there's a paragraph at the end that tells you. I think it's the second-to-last paragraph. But it's very subtle. There was a version of this book, an early draft, in which everything was tied up. And I actually came back 20 years later and described how the town was. And my editor looked at it and said, no, 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 no. because she's very subtle that way, you know, 7 or 8 no's, and I begin to understand what she's saying. So she allowed me a couple of paragraphs. And
yes,
so,
I found
so
it.
This one says, yes, here was the place Philippe would return to and bit by bit recover with the help of a woman as steady as rock and find himself healed by the joyous, exhausting duties of fathering. Here was the place that the future lived.
Yes, and it's funny that I didn't remember that because in some ways the ending is a bit inconclusive. We kind of skip from one not quite ultimate moment to the future.
To me, the ultimate moment was Emma actually allowing herself to hope.
Mm.
Her arc is complete at the moment that she puts that chocolate in her mouth and experiences hope. Here's the other thing. When I was doing my research about D-Day, you know, there's whole literature of fantastic stuff about D-Day, magnificent novels, fantastic historical books, unforgettable films, and they all were about the battle. And so I was determined to have as little battle in this book as I possibly could. It had already been done so well. I figured just about everybody who picks up this novel has seen Private Ryan, right? So Saving Private Ryan. So in fact, only about 4 pages of battle in the whole book. It's really very much down at the most intimate level. And there's one moment when a German officer that the reader's gotten to know pretty well sees for a page the battle and realizes that he's fallen for a myth. And another situation when Emma, our heroine, is up in a tree and sees the battle and experiences this the most profound kind of wave of humility that these thousands of young men would lay down their lives for her and her people. And I wanted to steer away from that and make it about the great battle stuff and make it about the intimate experience of these characters. And so to have it come down to literally what a starving person puts in her mouth and what she experiences, this is it. I wanted it to be an intimate ending, not an epic one.
Right. And you have some other wonderful characters also in the book. One of them is Monkey Boy. He's a minor character, but you know, an important note. Talk about him.
Well, one of the things is that was fun with this book is there's an ensemble, right? It's a village, and so there's all kinds of characters. And I gave myself permission in a way I never have before to have these characters at large and just running around loose in the novel, and they turn up at different times. There's a guy who's a veteran of World War I and now a farmer. There's a horse that he has turned loose and that wanders around and shows up at different times. And what I found is rather than making the novel disorganized, those characters became really useful forces and powerful forces, and they would show up. And my favorite was actually, well, my second favorite was Monkey Boy. My favorite was a rooster named Pirate, who just is such a Frenchman for a rooster. But Monkey Boy is a boy of some mental deficit, and they call him Monkey Boy because he climbs trees all the time. And it also gives him actually a different point of view, a different vantage point, and his simplicity clarifies things sometimes. And then there's a moment, you know, I did want Emma to get up in that tree so that she could see the battlefield, but she's been quite beaten up by that point. She's not able to lift herself 1 inch, much less all the way up in a tree. And I had this predicament. How is she going to get to the battlefield or near the beaches and be able to see it? And I was really stuck. And I remembered, I have Monkey Boy, and he's been climbing these trees all the time. He's actually strong. And so there's a way that by creating this ensemble that I actually had a full quiver, that I had all kinds of resources that I could use to enrich the narrative. I'd never done that before, and I'm going to try and do it more in the future because as a writer, it's wonderful to have such resources that it's all there. The rabbit is already in the hat, you might say. So Monkey Boy I loved, and one of the things that was hard about taking out the 20 years later section that I removed was that I continued to tell the story of Monkey Boy, what happens to him. He's 17 in the course of this novel, 17 years old. What it's like for him when he's 47. And I think it's really I leave it to the reader's imagination what becomes of Monkey Boy. But I think we know that this community will take care of him, because he's heroic in his own way.
Hmm.
and everyone has a way of contributing. Again, it's not the superhero. It's almost the opposite of the superhero. It's a boy who climbs trees and is simple.
Right. Now, the battle scenes may only take up 4 pages, but they're very powerful. And you also have...
Thank you.
There's another scene in which, Emma, you mentioned she gets beaten up. I've always wondered, because for me, I'm one of those people who hides my eyes when there's, like, go to the movies and there's violence on the screen.
Yes.
I can't bear to watch it. What's it like to write scenes of such violence?
Well, that's interesting. You're the first person ever asked that question, and I'll tell you, it's rough. And what I felt, especially because I did read the other books about this and see the films, you know, Saving Private Ryan, it's 35 minutes of slaughter, that I wanted it to be very, very particular and very, very brief and of breathtaking violence. So there is a moment, and I don't want to give it away if your listeners haven't read the book yet, but there's, for example, early in the book, there's an execution. And I want that execution I want the reader to feel it in their deepest core. And it's about 4 sentences long. But it is so violent that I want it to set the tone for the rest of the book in some ways. And there are, in fact, there are 3 executions in the course of the book, and there are some glimpses of the battle, and there is a violent incident involving Emma, and then there's almost another violent incident involving Emma. And each of these is quite short, very much on purpose. Sometimes I worked in newspapers for a lot of years, and one of the things you do, I ran a city desk, and you assign each story a certain number of inches. That's how long the reporter has of inches down the page that their story can be. And sometimes I would assign myself inches. This is how long this scene can be. It cannot be more than 1 page. It cannot be more than 2 paragraphs. To make myself bear it down to what is the detail that will make this scorching and then over. Wasabi violence. You know, I want it to be really hot and then gone.
Right. In fact, I wrote myself a little note in that scene that you mentioned that I thought to myself that before the current election, I might have thought a little bit differently about that scene than now, meaning this, that before the election, it would have been a shocker, but it would have been very distant. But now, since then, there's so much, the temperature of violence has gone up so much that now I felt that scene as something that could happen to me.
Well, here's how I feel. I mean, if you write historical fiction, I think for it to work, it has to echo the current moment. It has to reflect on the current moment in some way where the past can inform the present. And in politics of today and the cultural moment of today.
Wait, could you say that again? Because somebody is trying to call in, so just say that sentence again. Because they got a little bleep that
okay.
You can hear.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So One of the purposes of writing historical fiction is to reflect on the present moment. That is to say, there's something in the past that can teach us something of value in the present. And this is why I'm drawn to write historical fiction when I'm not a historian. So in this book, I believe that the political reflection is that sometimes the most defiant thing that people can do is take care of one another. And I believe that that is a reflection and an evolution that needs to happen in our culture in this time, that we need to stop fighting and start taking care of each other.
Absolutely.
And if not, it's over.
Yes. Well, that's so powerful, and I want to thank you so much for saying that. It feels like a good place to end talking about The Baker's Secret, but I have one other question for you, which is,
yes.
You're writing a new book?
I am, and it's the opposite of The Baker's Secret, which once I figured out the location and the research and that and so on, Baker's Secret came out in this great flow of love, and I've never loved my characters more, and it just poured out of me. Lots of revision, of course, but it poured out of me. Now I'm writing a book that's been immensely difficult. It is based on an actual person who was a young man, a mathematician, in 1943, and he ended up, kind of against his will, working on the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and he ended up designing the detonator for the atomic bomb with great moral qualms and lots of pangs of conscience. And, of course, the detonators worked. And after the war, he was offered a full ride to Stanford to get a PhD in physics. And he went thinking he'd study acoustics and so on, and he got there, and it was all bomb. New bombs, bigger bombs, the hydrogen bomb, thermonuclear bombs, all of this. And he lasted 6 weeks, and he quit and took a job with a company that repairs church organs. And when he died in 1983, he was pretty much globally recognized as the greatest cathedral organ builder in human history.
Wow.
And so this is a fictionalization of his life, and it is, above all, a love story that is narrated by his widow after he has died. So and right now it's called The Universe of Two, and it's supposed to be out in late 2019 or early 2020, and it's already the longest book I've ever written. And I've learned a lot of really fun things about cathedral organs and have stood in the pipes and had my ears blasted. And I've learned enough about atomic bombs that I could probably build one in my garage if I had spare plutonium lying around. And I'm completely immersed. And it is not coming out in a flow of love. I am having to earn every word because it's complicated and a wonderful challenge. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, we'll have to talk with you about that book when it's published.
My pleasure. You can tell I can talk about it. Yes.
Well, that's great. Well, Stephen Kiernan, your current book that's out is The Baker's Secret. It's a terrific read, and I want to thank you so much for such an interesting conversation.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Read an excerpt from The Baker's Secret by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.